Good Monday morning. I'm Tom Maloney filling in for Chris Nolte on this special edition of Regionally Speaking. Coming up in the show today, Chris will talk with Leanne Angerman, the Assistant Director of the Lake County Board of Elections and Registration, about tomorrow's primary election. We'll also hear from Andy Downs, taking a look at mail-in ballots and the impact it might have here across the Hoosier State. And of course, the big news over the weekend, the riots and the protests, not only across the country and across the state, but right here in Northwest Indiana. I'll talk with Michael Puente about that and the latest updates from the protests that happened over the weekend at South Lake Mall. All of that and more coming up on this edition of Regionally Speaking. But first, the news.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We are just hours away from another election. In this case, it's the election that would have been held back in early May, but now it's June 2nd, this time for the primary election here in Lake County and all across Indiana. Let's find out how preparations are going here in Lake County. A conversation with Leanne Angerman. She is the Assistant Director of the Lake County Board of Elections and Registration.
We're speaking on Thursday, and that means we just have days to go before the June 2nd election, which is Tuesday. And we're also up to the deadline, I guess, for people to take advantage of the early voting opportunities. How do we first seem to be doing here in Lake County as far as the absentee ballots? We had a lot of applications go out, and any clues yet or any supposition as how the ballots are going to come in? Even ahead of the actual election day on Tuesday the 2nd.
Well, we did have an increased volume of applications come in. In fact, we had 31,692 come in. At this point, we have just over 23,000 ballots that have come back. So it's still a significant number have already come in. We can accept those through noon on election day. So we do expect that number to go up each day. With that, we do still have early voting. It will be running through Monday at noon. So they will have Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 8 to 7, Monday until noon to early vote if they would like to early vote. For anyone who submitted their absentee ballot application and did not receive their ballot, or receive their ballot and don't feel that they have enough time to return it, to the county in sufficient time, they are able to take that ballot and surrender it at an early voting location or a polling location on election day and be able to still vote in person.
Because everybody that receives an absentee ballot knows what precinct they're in. It's printed on the ballot, on the information that they get in the mail from the election board. And if they don't happen to know what their precinct is, they can look it up and find out where it is they want to surrender that ballot. And this way it all gets counted.
Yes, it would be on the ballot that was returned to them. They could also go on to IndianaVoters.com and search for their precinct and also their polling location. Their polling locations are also listed on our website at lakecountyin.org. So they could go to that location. They could also call our office, our main line, 755-3795, if they need to find out what their polling location is. We're happy to assist them either way.
Now, Leanne, I know that because of the coronavirus pandemic, this caused, of course, the unprecedented state record for absentee ballots that have gone out and will probably come back on election day. Has that had a major effect that you can tell this far advance, I guess, as to how early voting is? Because that would mean people would have to actually go someplace, and they may not feel comfortable going out and going into a polling place, even though it's been sanitized and everybody's taking the proper precautions there.
We have people at both ends of the spectrum. We have people who certainly wanted to take advantage of the absentee voting by mail without reason. So that was the increase, you know, that we saw in that number. But we still have a lot of people who prefer in-person voting. So we were glad to be able to offer the 1 week of early voting as well as in-person voting on election day. We just have a lot of people that are comfortable with it and still prefer that method. So we're very thankful that the voters are able to vote in the manner that they prefer.
Now for Tuesday, June 2nd, election day itself, what precautions will be out there at all of the precinct polling places that will be open for people to come vote in person if they choose to do so?
We received a large shipment of supplies from the Secretary of State, Connie Lawson's office. that included surface cleaner, hand sanitizer, gloves, masks, some face shields, and some what we call sneeze guards, some shields to go in between the clerk and the voter when they come in. For all locations, they will receive gloves or finger cots for the voters to use, as well as the surface cleaner, microfiber towels, the hand sanitizer, masks as well. So all the precincts will receive that. The larger precincts, as well as the precincts in the two communities that had the largest number of active cases, will also receive the sneeze guards that will go in between the clerks and the voter when they're signing in on the iPad because they have an extended period of time of exposure. The clerks will also receive face shields that we were able to get from the Secretary of State, as well as Valpo University and ITT Tech. There were some supplies that we were able to purchase from the office, very limited as the supply chains were dry. But combining all of those resources together, we were able to put together a nice kit for each precinct for the voters and the poll workers to have.
What's the situation going to be election night once the polls close? Mm-hmm. And what's taken in from those precinct polling places or the area polling places, depending on how it is, and brought back to the county government center or to the other locations? Usually I know there are locations out and around the county where materials are brought in and they in turn are transferred into the main office, so to speak. What's it going to be like on Tuesday night, June 2nd here, after the polls close at 6 o'clock in the evening? Something different or pretty much the same as what we've seen?
We do have three drop-off sites. The main drop-off site, of course, being the Lake County Government Complex here in Crown Point. We also have the Geary Airport as well as Wicker Park. So as materials are brought in there, the tally cards are taken to the counting room, where they are scanned in and read. For the two drop-off locations, Geary Airport and Wicker Park, we will have deputy election commissioners with police officers who will transport them back to the county in two separate runs to get the tally cards back here faster to get to vote totals as quickly as possible.
Since we know this is such an extraordinarily different election, and we've already mentioned the fact that you're hoping with any luck and no problems along the way, that the ballots coming in, not only the absentee ballots that will be already come in through the mail or by people bringing them in or dropping and surrendering them and then voting into the machines on election day, and you mentioned it's going to be a Wednesday night, your hopes to have ballots counted. Does it look like that's going to pretty much hold, or do you, I guess, have anything that you have to do ahead of time to make sure that you follow through with your goal of Wednesday night to have the ballots all counted?
There have certainly been additional logistics that we've had to go through to make arrangements for this election. Of course, that being an increased number in staff, an increase in the space that we use. We've had to make arrangements to use additional space to set up the counters to provide for them to have a safe counting area and the PPE equipment that they need to be able to conduct that process safely. So it's just a matter of giving them enough time to count and do what they need to do.
Are you getting any clues, by the way, that people are anxious? They're anxious, of course, they've had to do something different. But do you think that maybe even the candidates that are out there that are on the ballot this time around, are they anxious to want to find out as much as soon as they can about what's happening?
Of course they are. Having been a candidate myself, you want those results as quickly as you can possibly get them. So I know it's going to be a little bit of an extra burden on our candidates to have to wait any longer than normal to receive the results. So we ask for their patience, and we understand that it is a different time. It's different for the voters to wait for results. It's different for our staff and the candidates. So we are handling it, I think, as everyone has handled the crisis, with patience and with some ingenuity to come up with some creative methods to get the jobs done that we need to do.
Leanne Angerman, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on the election process for this very unique time for the primary election coming up on Tuesday the 2nd.
Thank you very much.
As we look to not only the Lake County election and the election in Porter and LaPorte and our surrounding counties as well, the rest of the state of Indiana has a June 2nd primary election to deal with. And, of course, all of the precautions that state election officials want to make sure that local election officials have in dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. Let's find out the latest. We'll check with Andy Downs, who's the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. And Andy, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, first, what's your assessment of how we are as far as preparation for this election that's coming up here?
It's very interesting because we have several factors that are complicating things. There's the fact that the date was changed, which confused some folks. There was the fact that we actually had a loosening up of the rules regarding voting by mail, which confused some people. There's the pandemic going on, which is making some people worried about going out to vote. And then, of course, obviously, the activities of the past week have now caused some people to be a little bit concerned as well about being able to vote, being able to get to their polling location. So there's an awful lot going on right now that is complicating things. But if we start with the vote-by-mail movement that's been pushed, I just want to kind of put this a little bit into perspective for folks. In 2016, in the last presidential election, there were about 15,000 absentee ballots cast in Lake County alone. And this year, there were 32,000 applications alone for voting by mail, let alone what people would do if they vote early. So you're looking at a 2-to-1 increase there. In LaPorte, it's actually like a 4 to 5 times increase in the number of applications over actual absentee ballots cast.
Uh-huh.
So it's clear that people have decided to vote by mail. What we don't know is how much that will cause the turnout on election day to go down. We've obviously assumed that it will go down, but there's no guarantee of that.
I know that the election officials locally have taken the advice of the state election division and got themselves as prepared as they can so they can be able to safely handle as many people as they can.
Yeah, and if you look early voting, for example, I know here, if you go to vote early in Allen County, you were actually given a mask, you were given a glove so that you never had to touch anything with an ungloved hand.
Mm-hmm.
And similar things are happening around the state. There's hand sanitizer that's available. And then there were even some polling locations that were moved in some counties so that they could be in larger rooms with, you know, more air and more ability to have people spacing themselves out. Fortunately, at this point, it looks like we're going to have some decent weather. So even if your line spreads outside, you're not going to be caught out in the rain in many instances. And that will be good in terms of helping to keep social distance. People won't be trying to pack themselves into room to get out of the weather. But still, you know, this is an interesting time to be thinking about going out to vote.
I know there's always the concern about making sure that everybody has an opportunity to vote. And I know that in this coronavirus pandemic year of the election, we're certainly going to have that concern as well, too. I know that the election, local election officials are going to do their best to make sure that their staff, their people at the polling places, not only have all of the proper public health materials to deal with, but they probably need to do some instruction to remind the voters that they are going to be seeing when they do come in the door at the polling places that even though they're not wearing a mask, they can still vote.
Yeah, you know, it's confusing for people. I mean, you think about, let's just go with banking as an example, because that's something that people do on a far more regular basis than voting. You know, banks used to have up signs that say, no mask, take your scarves off, all that sort of stuff when you walked in, because they actually wanted to be able to get a look at you. And if you were there to do something bad, to make sure it was caught on camera. And mm-hmm. Now you can walk into a bank with a mask on. Similar sorts of things are going to be happening here, that people are going to show up with their mask on, as we hope a lot of people will do, and they'll be asked for their ID, which is required by law. And the people who are working there, in some respects, are going to make a judgment based on what they can see outside of the mask for identification purposes. But let's also keep in mind, though, that, you know, we do know what people's signatures look like. We are talking about precinct workers, many of whom have been doing this work year after year after year, and they know what their voters look like. They're familiar with, you know, Jane Doe and John Doe who are coming in to vote. So there are still a number of safety precautions in place to make sure that only those people who should be voting will be voting. But it is going to be a very, very different scenario than usual. And not only machine instruction, as you pointed out, though, but the need to remind people that, you know, once you put that glove on, use only that hand to touch the machine and the pen and all that sort of stuff. It will be a different set of instruction that the precinct workers have to give.
Mm-hmm. I know that there have been some concerns, I guess, to make sure that the people at the polling places realize that if they're not absolutely sure who that person is, that maybe is wearing a mask for health safety reasons, that they're still allowed to vote. It's their constitutional right to be able to vote. You can't refuse them a vote because they're wearing a mask. And I know that's going to be a big concern tomorrow.
That is going to be confusing for people. We'll see how much that happens. Mm-hmm. Obviously, some folks might be a little more aggressive in their enforcement of that than others. I've been around elections for a long time, and fortunately, the overwhelming majority of people who are working on Election Day are there to make sure that the election runs smoothly and that people have their chance to vote. So, you know, those things happen, but usually they are very small in examples. And other people who are working at a precinct are quite often there, or a polling location, are there to help make sure that that person who's getting a little overly aggressive in enforcement gets tamped down a little bit, and people who should be allowed to vote get that chance.
We're talking with Andy Downs, who is with the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University Fort Wayne, about the upcoming election, the one that's going to be held on Tuesday, June 2nd. And speaking of the election itself, well, I guess there are, of course, a lot of local races in some counties, maybe more in others than in some. But there, at least we know there are going to be two big areas that will have big elections because there are so many candidates. And we're talking, at least for us, about the first congressional district race for the Democrats and the Republicans. How do things seem to shape up right up to the election day?
You know, I sort of joked that I needed to look at the list of official candidates to make sure you and I weren't running. That's how many people are actually running for that.
At one point,
I thought everybody was running for that first district seat. It is a very, very hotly contested race. It's an open seat, and that's really the driving factor here. Whenever you have an open seat, you have a far greater number of qualified candidates who decide to seek the office. And that's in part because incumbents get reelected at ridiculously high rates, 80%, 90%, depending on the election. But with the retirement of Representative Visclassi, we now have an open seat that a lot of Democrats see as a seat that would be a safe seat if they can win it. It should be the sort of seat they can hold on to for literally decades. And that's what brought out, I think it is 15 different people who are seeking that seat on the Democratic side. The Republicans, though, also see that it's an open seat, and they recognize that if there's a chance to win it, it probably is in the year of an open seat. And that's why you have, I think it is 6 people running on the Republican side. So it's a heavily populated area. But what changes the dynamic now, though, is that instead of needing, you know, 50% plus 1% of the vote, now you just need some much smaller plurality of the vote. When you spread the vote out among 6 candidates or 10 or 15 candidates, suddenly if you can secure 25, maybe 30% of the vote, you can be the person who actually wins. And that means some people who would not win a runoff between a couple of people are suddenly able to win because they have a solid constituency that will stick with them and give them that 25 or 30 or 35% in just about every kind of race. When you have people dividing up the votes among, you know, 10, 15 candidates, suddenly 25 or 35% might be enough to win.
And also, too, we not only have political party candidates that are up for nomination, but we have in some communities, and in particularly here in Lake County, in South Lake County, the Hanover Community School Corporation has a referendum question or two on the ballot, and that's going to be something that the residents down there are going to have to take a look at.
It's interesting to watch the evolution of referendum votes, because if we go back, you know, 10, 15 years when we started seeing these, the schools just, you know, they would pass the appropriate paperwork through and then get the item on the agenda and didn't necessarily aggressively campaign like they needed to. And they realized, after so many of them were defeated early on in this process, that they decided, well, we need to treat these like campaigns. And so they began doing much better job of reaching out to the community, explaining why things were necessary, treating it basically like a campaign. And that then brought, of course, far more victories in those school referenda races. For a while, people thought that the victories were only in affluent school districts. And what some research actually showed is that the affluence of the district quite often was not the deciding factor. You actually saw some very affluent districts defeat referenda, and you saw some districts that are at the other end of the economic spectrum approving things. And that's in part because of the way the schools went out and sold the need to the public. The school district referenda now are an interesting campaign to watch because they have to be treated like campaigns. There are people, of course, who don't like the fact that some of them are held during a primary because primaries tend to have lower turnout. They'd like to see them run during general elections when you have higher turnout. That's something we'll have to wait and see if the legislature mandates later on.
That's interesting to find out, especially with the fact that this is going to probably be one of those mail-in ballot elections, to be sure. And finally, Andy, if you will, give us your thoughts about the fact that usually we get the chance to be able to give people the results. The tally comes in by the end of the evening, maybe early in the morning on the next day. But this time we're talking about, in some cases, it may be literally days before we find out how the elections actually turned out. What are your thoughts about the fact that we had this big delay instead of just maybe 12 hours, maybe 48, 72 hours before we find out who won?
If you go back in time, this is actually going to be a little bit more like what we used to experience decades ago. And then there was a big push as we moved to electronic voting systems to get the totals out as quickly as possible. You know, it got to the point where by the evening news or the nighttime news, results were expected, not hoped for, but actually expected. And if they didn't come out then, there were almost accusations that election boards were somehow, you know, hiding results or something had gone wrong in the tabulating of votes and sort of didn't recognize the reality that sometimes counting votes just takes a little bit longer. Our desire for immediate gratification is going to be challenged significantly this time around. I know here, for example, in Allen County, they actually are planning on doing the big count on Wednesday. So really on Tuesday night, there will be some quick results that come out from the machines that were used on Election Day. But a large number of votes, enough to swing the outcome of some of the elections, will not have been counted. So we're going to see an interesting Tuesday night. And then, as you pointed out, it could be on Wednesday we hear the results. It could be Thursday. It could be Friday. And that's going to change the way we're able to see these things on the news. It's going to change the awareness of what's happening. I hope that what happens is people actually pay a little more attention to the news for a few days because they're waiting to hear the results from different races. And those come out, those trickle out over days as opposed to being all announced at one time. I hope that, because that means people are paying attention to the news and becoming better informed. But the reality is we know we are not going to know the results on Tuesday, and we really probably won't even know all of them on Wednesday. It will be Thursday or Friday in some cases because of the number of paper ballots that are being sent in by mail.
Yeah, especially here in Lake County, and for sure I know that they'll do their best to see if they can at least get a particular precinct's mail-in ballots counted, put into the box, so to speak, and have that ready so when the boxes are going out to the polling places, and when they finally get back in later in the day Tuesday, as they always do, go to the drop-off points, and then things get tallied up, they'll have something they can work on then. But we'll all just have to wait and see, I guess. Well, as always, Andy, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about this election, which is very important in many different ways this time around. And we'll be back with you sometime through the week, maybe before they get all the ballots tallied, and we'll know something better about how the outcome of all these races have come out. Thank you very much for talking today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Andy Downs is the executive director of the Mike Downs Center for Indiana Politics at Purdue University, Fort Wayne. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. A new app is going out there for your phone and your other devices to help you try to navigate all of the problems that we're going to see, no doubt, with the 2020 elections this year. The Politicking app is what it's called. And let's talk with one of the co-founders, who happens to be from Northwest Indiana. Jordan Wilson is with us. And Jordan, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to join you and speak about the work I'm doing to galvanize young voters through politicking.
That's very important this year. We know that with the candidates out there, regardless of whether they're incumbents or they're challengers, there's going to be something for someone out there to take a look at. And a lot of information that's going to be out there, too, to have to sift through for all the candidates that will be on the ballot this year, to be sure. How did the idea of coming up with an app for that, pardon the phrase, come in your mind, you and your colleagues, when you were just a young person in Gary, Indiana?
Yes. Well, you know, to your point earlier, it's really difficult to sift through political information, and in some instances, it's actually impossible. And so the idea to establish politicking originated out of necessity through my co-founder and I. She is a Florida resident, and as you stated, I'm an Indiana voter, and we both sort of relished on the fact that voting in the 2016 election was not as straightforward and simple as it should be. And as we live in such an internet age, we have access to information constantly about current events and political happenings. But until we started politicking, there was no centralized platform, and certainly not a nonpartisan one, that would help you understand what issues and who was on the ballot. So understanding that we didn't want to experience another election in which we couldn't just understand from top to bottom who a person was before walking into the booth, started politicking to create a tool that would allow voters to feel more informed, but definitely empowered as to who they were voting for on election day.
Now, do you think that because this seems to not necessarily be aimed at, I'm sure it's for everybody, but young voters in particular, people maybe even their very first election, that they happen to walk into the polling booth and have to figure out who they want to vote for, it's going to be a big help for them.
Yeah, and that's actually the purpose. You know, the demographics of different elections, and certainly for the general election, will shift and are constantly shifting. In fact, 2020 will be the first time in which Hispanic Americans are growing towards the majority in our electorate. It's important that we have platforms that speak to each group, of course, but as you say, and that's able to break down the information simply and directly so that they can make choices that are in the best interest of their communities.
I know that the idea is basically to have the latest and the best information on local, state, and national elections. But do you think this also, too, is going to maybe help in trying to kind of kick up kick it up a notch, so to speak, to get the apathy issue out of the voting?
Yeah. Actually, you're absolutely right. As I stated to you earlier, our goal is to galvanize young and traditionally disenfranchised voters. And so, of course, the core information piece is important, but it's no way, at least we imagine our theory of change is that there's no way someone can walk into the booth and not feel more empowered, not feel more inspired and motivated to participate if they actually know what their plan is and who they plan to support.
When you and your colleagues working on this, before you got it to the point where you could actually launch the app here not long ago, did you find that there were some challenges that you found along the way, that you had the little bugs that you had to take out of the mix, so to speak, before you knew that it was going to be a very successful app?
Absolutely. So one thing that we're constantly challenged with is staying diligent about maintaining our data, making sure that it's updated, making sure that it's accurate, and making sure that it's not left or right leading. We are a nonpartisan app, so we want to ensure that the information our users get is completely filtered out and just straightforward and objective. As you know, we've experienced for the last couple of months folks dropping out of the 2020 presidential election, not being dramatic, but in the double-digit numbers. At a certain point, there were 20-plus candidates. And so that was our first sort of challenge, making sure that we had updated information about our country's biggest election. But at the local level, that's true also for the first district congressional race. There are several candidates. And so even taking a look at that sort of challenge in terms of making sure people have accurate and updated information for so many candidates is really important for an entity like politicking, but it's certainly one that we're growing to become more accustomed to working through, and it's something that we're obviously dedicated to making sure mm-hmm. that we stay on top of so that our users can trust our information.
Let's talk here a little bit more about the first congressional district race here. We know that there are a lot of candidates, more than a dozen in just one party alone, the Democratic Party alone.
Yeah.
And it kind of boils down to basically about one-fourth of the field are really well-known, and then the rest of the field is hardly known at all. It's not the fault of the candidates necessarily. It's just the way it is. Do you find it's been very difficult, like, for example, that is a good example of how you can, with the app, be able to try and even out the flow of information and the opinions, the viewpoints and all, to try to make it so that all of the candidates are equally placed along the way, so it's not just the important names that are out there, the people that have the more well-known personalities, the experience being in politics over the years, opposed to some of the other people that are just really citizens that want to run for Congress.
Yes, it's incredibly difficult, Chris. And I'll tell you two things that we're doing. One is, mm-hmm. as we said, making sure the information that we share about the race is not static. It should be constantly changing. It should be updated towards what candidates are saying about their platforms. And it should be updated to reflect the objective stance that we take towards their platforms and the race. And then two things, the second thing is that we're driving online content towards our users so that they have an understanding of each race. We have a large following from the region, naturally. And so what we're doing is hosting a candidate roundtable this month on our Instagram and on our online platform so that users can have a chance to actually listen and engage with these candidates directly. It is impossible for everyone, as you said, in the primary race to actually build up some level of momentum and familiarity that will allow them to sort of have the immediate name recognition that, as you said, about a fourth of the pool has.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not impossible for us to take some responsibility in the race to at least familiarize users with each candidate so that they actually know who they are when they see them on election day.
Well, Jordan, tell us how people can not only support but also download the Politicking app on their smartphones and be ready when they take that phone into the polling place on June 2nd.
Well, the first thing everyone who's listening needs to do is download Politicking. If you have an Android, you can download it in the Google Play Store. And if you have an iPhone, it's available for iOS in the Apple Store. The second thing that they should definitely do is visit our website at politickingapp.com. It's politickingapp.com. For anyone who loves Instagram, they can find us at politickingtheapp. And for all of our Twitter users, please follow us at politickingapp. That's our Twitter handle.
And don't forget, too, to be sure to follow the people along here with the Politicking app on Instagram here for these sessions coming up here this month as we get ready for another election coming up on June 2nd. And Jordan Wilson, thank you very much for spending time to going over the details, not only on how the Politicking app came about, but some of the work that you all have to do to keep it up and fresh and ready to go when people want to use it for an election coming up.
Chris, thank you so much for having me. I thank you for giving me a platform to speak to your listeners about how they can get involved in the upcoming election, and hope to speak with you again soon.
Certainly hope so, too. Jordan Wilson is a co-founder of the Politicking app.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking, a best-of edition here on Lakeshore Public Radio. In central Indiana, Sunday's curfew went into effect. People gathered to clean up the destruction from the Saturday night riot downtown, and faith leaders called for a peaceful protest, change, and political action. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Eric Weddle reports.
Sunday morning, a 17-year-old high school student named Mason drove 21 miles from his Hendricks County home to downtown Indianapolis.
Well, I woke up this morning and watched the local news and just saw everything destroyed last night, so this is my city too. So I came down here and I want to clean it up. That's what matters to me, especially the
in the Mile Square, an unknown number of business storefronts were smashed, city trucks damaged, graffiti tagged on sidewalks, buildings, and monuments. On Sunday, Mason was part of dozens attempting to bring order, sweeping up glass and boarding up windows. He found a group washing off graffiti. Strangers stopped by to give them a solution that breaks up the paint.
I believe the peaceful protest, that's the way to go. That's, you know, in our Constitution. But when it comes to rioting, you have no right to do that. You are destroying our community. And
on Friday and Saturday, peaceful protests were followed by riots.
This is the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. This is no longer a lawful assembly. You must get out of the street. You will be subject to arrest.
Some people went home, but others smashed windows, looted, and set fires on city streets. The chaos continued for hours. Police used tear gas and projectiles fired from guns to disperse groups. Some, like Indianapolis resident Anthony King, says the destruction will force leaders to address racism, police brutality, and economic inequality.
After this protesting, I do want everybody to come together and actually demand what we want. The protesting is cool. This showing them that we're serious, but we have to demand what we really want. Like a hostage situation, we have to demand what we want and then see what happens.
This system
is broken. It's not meant for us to succeed. It's really meant for us to be employees and be slaves.
On Sunday, in response to the riots, Mayor Joe Hogsett set a curfew to start at 8 p.m. Ahead of that curfew, faith leaders gathered in the afternoon to call for peaceful protests and accountability from elected officials and the police.
We are to be the voice of the voiceless.
Yes.
We are to be the agents of change.
Pastor J. Rashad Jones urged the hundreds gathered to take their anger out at the ballot box. If local, state, and federal officials do not speak out against police brutality, he says, vote them out.
Because the time is now. The opportunity is at hand. And the window of opportunity is only open for a short while. We cannot sit on the dock of the bay and watch the tide roll away, but we must come together and make sure that America lives up to its slogan, that this is the land of the free.
From the State House, people marched to the city market across from the city county building. There, hundreds laid down for 8 minutes, a die-in. The time represents how long a Minneapolis police officer kept his knee on George Floyd's neck. Floyd died. Faith leaders read out the names of black people killed by police over a loudspeaker. A drum beat twice for every name. Then the crowd turned to the city county building and pointed toward Hogsett's 25th floor office and chanted, "Not one more." For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Eric Weddle.
George Floyd died 1 week ago underneath the neck of Derek Chauvin, the now former Minneapolis police officer who has been arrested and charged with third-degree murder. And as a result of George Floyd's death, we have seen protests across the country. And almost a dozen more people now have died as a result of protests turning into riots across the country. I would say probably thousands of canisters of tear gas have been launched across the country as well. Not only across the country, but right here in Northwest Indiana. I'm Tom Maloney in for Chris Nolte on this edition of Regionally Speaking, joined in studio by Michael Puente, WBEZ's Northwest Indiana Bureau reporter, who was live on scene at South Lake Mall in Hobart yesterday. Michael, welcome back into the station.
Hey, Tom. Glad to be here.
It was a long day for you yesterday out in the sun. Set the scene a little bit for people who maybe didn't see the Facebook Live videos, maybe saw a picture in the newspaper this morning, whether it was the Times or the Post, about the protests happening at South Lake Mall and then eventually moving on to Route 30.
Well, I mean, the protests started off pretty peacefully at around a little shortly before 3 o'clock outside the main entrance of near the JCPenney entrance at the South Lake Mall, the north side of the mall. And a lot of speakers there, some pastors. There was some dialogue. As the protests continued, in fact, some of the protests were actually chanting no looting. And you had some dialogue back and forth. Hobart Mayor Brian Snedecor was there talking to some of the protesters. I think what agitated a lot of the protesters were the presence of police, not just police, but in full tactical gear. They saw snipers on the roof. Well, they looked like snipers. Mm-hmm. They could have shot rubber pellets or whatever. The rubber pellets could hurt, I'm sure. But they were there to protect the property because later on in the afternoon, Lake County Sheriff Oscar Martinez says, look, we're going to give the protesters their First Amendment rights to express their opinion, but some are coming with ill intent. Mm-hmm. So it should be noted that most of the protesting yesterday was peaceful. Now, there was some heated dialogue coming from some of the protesters. So some were getting really close into the face of some of the officers who sort of stood their ground. Some of the protesters were shouting profanities, threats, taunting. That's a lot to take. It was a lot to hear coming from female, male, black, white, Hispanic. Just a lot of emotion yesterday.
What was the scene like overall at the mall? You talk about the emotion and the heatedness of it, but did it feel like things could have potentially, no pun intended, because it didn't happen, but blow up? Or did it feel like this is the daytime, this is nice and easy, people are just airing their frustrations out?
I mean, no, there was a, you know, it felt like it was a powder keg. That's, you know, one little thing could mm-hmm. have kind of set the whole thing off. And I know some of the protesters were upset to see the heavy police presence there. But if you take into account everything that's happening in Chicago, in the South Suburbs, nationwide, mm-hmm. Authorities were just very worried about any kind of property damage. This is a mall that had been closed for what, a month, 2 months, and just reopened last week, just for a few days, and now they had to shut again yesterday a lot of the businesses there. So there's a lot of tense moments. The police felt they had to do what it needed to do to protect property and people from getting injured.
We also saw on your videos as well that police had the canine units out when the crowd then either left South Lake Mall or was a separate crowd that was actually stopping traffic on Route 30, that they actually closed traffic from between Mississippi to Colorado streets or Colorado to Mississippi, depending on which direction right. You're going on Route 30. Basically, Walmart all the way until the Starbucks / mall entrance there. Right. That was the full scope of the shutdown on Route 30. Police dogs are there, the SWAT team, the tactical units there as well. At least three helicopters on scene. What was that like as that crowd began to move?
Well, it seemed about an hour after the protest started at the entrance of the mall, some of those organizers left. And mm-hmm. that left a sizable crowd of young people, about maybe 200, that started to go down US 30 to block traffic. And that's exactly what they did. Block traffic, I believe, on the westbound lanes, and there were motorists stuck. So the sheriff department came out to try to get those motorists out of harm's way. Mm-hmm. The protesters they shut down traffic on both sides, and that was there. There was a standoff for about a good 2 hours. Yes, you did have the canine units out. You had some pretty heavy military style equipment out there by the sheriff. Heavy police presence, full riot gear. As the crowd started to march west towards I-65, there was fear that they could get on I-65 and disrupt that traffic. Mm-hmm. The sheriff's office cut it off at Mississippi. And at some point, I think it was around 6:30, it was getting to be sunset. That's when the tear gas was dispensed.
Yeah.
And that tear gas got into a lot of areas. And some protesters started marching south on Mississippi towards the Popeye's Chicken, mm-hmm. places like that. I think the I was told that the glass at the Popeye's Chicken was smashed.
I saw that on Twitter, yeah. unconfirmed. I didn't right. drive by Popeye's this morning on my way into the station to, right. to verify whether or not that was the case.
So we did see people getting apprehended. I think at last count, about 10 people were apprehended. It really felt, in my observation, that the people who came out to protest were not the same people who were going to do looting. Mm-hmm. It just seems like there's a disconnect there. I think there are some people who wanted to, you know, vent frustration. And some of the protesters did that in voicing their discontent with what is happening around the country between police and the African-American community. But then there are theirs who wanted to vent their frustration in other ways. And some of them wanted to do perhaps some destruction.
So let's talk about the peaceful protesting. We've seen that basically throughout the daytime all across the country, large cities, small cities. Of course, we saw protesting happening in Hammond as well over the weekend. Calumet City, just on the other side of the state line, seeing heavy, heavy looting during the daytime. Is there a difference in the atmosphere you feel like when the sun sets? Is it people maybe that are just tired, feeling frustrated that voices aren't being heard? Or is it the opportunists who say under the cover of dark, I might have some more protection?
It definitely feels like it's the opportunists. It's under the cover of dark. Police are more spread out. It's more sporadic. In Chicago, I think they had something like 10,000 calls last night. Northwest Indiana, you did hear a lot of things going off on the scanner. Things in Hammond, things in Merrillville. Not really too much in Gary. In fact, I was just told that they had two burglaries yesterday in Gary, and they're not even sure if it was related to any of this.
Yeah.
So they're looking into that. And we're still hearing reports of possible gatherings of protests in and around Northwest Indiana. You know, it just, you have to stay vigilant on, you know, I think a lot of people are encouraging protesting. It's the destruction of property that is troubling me, because a lot of these businesses, again, if they're locally owned, if they're mom and pop stores, even if they're corporate owned, I mean, a lot of them have been closed for 2 months. They're trying to reopen to start making money. By shutting them down, you're hurting not just the property and the business, you're putting people out of work.
I should also say this, that not only, you know, if it's a local fast food restaurant that might be owned by a McDonald's, a Wendy's, an Arby's, etc., it's normally a local business person that owns it and is paying for the franchisee rights to be able to run that operation.
Absolutely.
So you're not even necessarily attacking the big boy fast food industry. You're quite literally attacking the local business infrastructure there. So there is, I think, maybe some disconnect in terms of what people see and believe versus what's actually the truth. I remember seeing reports last night, or even just yesterday through the day, that people were talking about going and looting and rioting in Crown Point and in Valparaiso, in Schererville, where they said, quote, the rich people live. And so I had followed up with that with several individuals that I know that work in the public service departments across Northwest Indiana, both police and fire, and I live in Crown Point. So I came to the station, Mike, on the word that protesters were headed south, just to kind of keep an eye on the radio and TV stations here. On my way back home, I drove through the square of Crown Point, really quiet, no activity, which is always nice to see. But at the same time, I recognize and understand that there is some privilege there. I can go south of Route 30 just a couple of miles, and I can get off of Twitter. I can log off of Facebook. I can turn on Netflix, and I don't have to be confronted with what's happening. Did you hear anybody talking about that that privilege angle, talking about what it's like for some communities versus others in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, a little bit, but I think we should be careful in that with that, because there are people who live in the South County area who may want to voice, you know, their frustration with the local police department or with politics. We do know of the historic redlining that there's been in Northwest Indiana between where African Americans can live or can't live. So that
redlining, really quick, for those of you who might not know what that means, is sort of it's an invisible line put in place by basically society that says people of a certain ethnicity can't live here, right?
That's right. And we have to – people were saying, why protest at the mall? You have to understand the political dynamics that are working here. 40 years ago when South Lake Mall was built, it was built around cornfields. That mall is a symbol of the – whether rightful or wrong – as a symbol of the destruction of the retail market in Gary. A lot of businesses shut down. Once that mall opened, 50 years now that mall has been open, it was seen as a way to – it just didn't hurt businesses in Gary, but also in East Chicago, in Hammond, because it was a new way of doing things. That mall, the South Lake Mall, they still call it Merrillville, but we know it technically it's Hobart, Indiana. It's right in the crosshairs of people like Reverend Jesse Jackson and Louis Farrakhan. They know that mall distinctly. They were opposed to the building of it. Mm-hmm. It felt like it drove out a lot of dollars from the city of Gary. So that is looked upon as the beaming light of retail in Northwest Indiana. And, you know, whether some people have forgotten that history or not, there's a lot of tension in just the way Merrillville was developed in historical context. So, you know, so there's a lot of reasons why people are heading down there. But also, again, there are people who want to express their frustration. There can be white kids who just, hey, this is an opportunity for them to just, shout to the police. Mm-hmm. I mean, I saw this one white kid who was just giving it to the police department yesterday. Every expletive coming out of his mouth, every threat imaginable. And this is a white kid. Yeah. I've got video of it on my Facebook page. So it isn't just discontent by African Americans or other minorities. There are a lot of people, you know, whites included, who are venting as well. And some of the protesters or whatever may come from it could be people who live right in your community. So let's not assume they're coming from the North County.
So really quick, we have about 2 minutes left in this discussion before we join all in, Mike. But why do you think we didn't see protests in Gary? And maybe why haven't we seen protests in Gary over the years?
You know, people have made sarcastic remarks like, there's nothing to loot in Gary. That's not true. There are some areas, there are small mom and pop stores that can get hit just as well. We do know that there were protests, not yesterday, but months ago with the shooting, the killing of Rashad Cunningham. And mm-hmm. there are people representing Rashad Cunningham. Gary has one of the highest percentage of African-American residents in the country. They have an African-American mayor. At the time, too, was Karen Freeman Wilson and an African-American police chief. Things can happen there, too. It isn't just white officers on black individuals that are causing the problem. There's been tensions with black officers, with black individuals. It's a system problem. Why hasn't there been any breakout protests in Gary? I can't answer that. Maybe they feel that more attention will be made if it's down in Merrillville-Hobart area.
Michael Puente, Northwest Indiana Bureau reporter for WBEZ. You can hear his coverage of Northwest Indiana on WBEZ as well as right here on Lakeshore Public Radio. And, of course, you can tune in every Friday at 11 a.m. this time, every Friday, for Off Mic with Michael Puente. As Michael honors me with the name, I am El Guapo Tom Maloney.
El Guapo, sometimes always grumpy. He's
right.
Never grumpy. It's just a tease.
I appreciate your time, Mike. Wonderful coverage yesterday as well on the protests at the South Lake Mall in Hobart. It's coming up on 12 o'clock. We're going to get into All In right here on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, streaming online at lakeshorepublicradio.org.